From the Wings Archive, The Canadian Pornography Decision.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hate propaganda and pornography are international issues. They transcend boundaries of race, culture, sex, geography, and nation states. Unless and until the problem is acknowledged globally and acted upon locally, women and disadvantaged groups, in my view, don't stand a chance of ever achieving equality anywhere.
During a conference held at the University of Chicago, Canadian law professor and human rights scholar Kathleen Mahoney spoke about the issues surrounding pornography regulation in Canada. In specific, she discusses the landmark Canadian cases, Keekstra versus the Crown and R versus Butler, cases she herself argued before the court, in which hate speech and pornography, respectively, were found to have limited claims for protection against regulation as forms of expression. She explains how the court was able to place the freedom of expression ideal within a context that takes into account those who have been traditionally shut out of the political process, namely the poor, the oppressed, the powerless, racial minorities, and women. This she refers to as the court's purposive approach to the law.
Now, when the decisions came down in the Keekstra trilogy and in Butler, many Americans gasped in disbelief. I think a lot of Americans sometimes see us Canadians as a little off the wall, and these decisions seem to confirm it. Historically, you've seen our conservatism as liberal, our liberalism as socialist, and our socialism as beyond the pale. But when our Supreme Court decided to interpret our constitutional guarantees of freedom of expression contrary to First Amendment values, many seemed to think that we had lost our grip completely. I experienced this personally because I was at the other end of the telephone in numerous interviews by supposedly objective members of the American press who found it very difficult to disguise their incredulousness at the assault on Western culture these decisions represented. The assault on the civil libertarian culture of individual autonomy, the assault on the social and economic culture of unbridled capitalism, and the assault on the sexist and racist culture of subordination and violence. Why would Canadian judges suddenly launch such an assault on these shared cultural values? That was the number one question. I think a partial explanation is provided by one of our greatest judges and intellectual leaders of the Supreme Court, Madam Justice Bertha Wilson, when she recently spoke of the role of government in Canadian society. Comparing Canadian to American attitudes, she said, Canadians recognize that government has traditionally had and continues to have an important role to play in the preservation of a just Canadian society. It is, in my view, untenable to suggest that freedom is coextensive with the absence of government. Experience shows the contrary, that freedom has often required the intervention and protection of government against private action. I think a more complete explanation has to do with the entrenchment in 1982 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This was a turning point. With the advent of the Charter, Canada became a different kind of society than it was before. Our social culture, as well as our legal culture, changed. We are no longer just a democratic federation whose constitutional players are federal and provincial governments fighting over powers. In 1982, the people of Canada got a piece of the constitutional action. Equality seekers in particular, after the most massive lobbying effort in Canada's history, achieved an amazingly comprehensive set of equality rights, guaranteeing equality before the law, under the law, and equal protection and equal benefit of the law. An affirmative action clause was entrenched, as well as a blanket guarantee of gender equality in the exercise of charter rights, and a multiculturalism clause mandating that the charter be interpreted in a manner consistent with the preservation and enhancement of the multicultural heritage of Canadians. Moreover, the Charter provided a clean constitutional slate, an opportunity to correct embarrassing past mistakes made under the Bill of Rights, and to develop the law in a principled manner consistent with an evolving, democratic, pluralistic society that likes to think of itself as tolerant and understanding. The majority of the judges sitting on our highest court were prepared to accept the challenge for change that the new charter presented in a creative, purposive, uniquely Canadian way. The desire to forge a uniquely Canadian constitutional jurisprudence is clear in the judicial comments from the early days of charter interpretation. Former Chief Justice Dixon and others urged that care be taken to avoid mechanical applications of concepts developed in different cultural and constitutional contexts, in different ages, and in very different circumstances. American jurisprudence in particular was referred to both substantively and procedurally, strongly supporting the court's rejection of the framers' intent approach to constitutional interpretation. Justice Wilson quite pointedly criticized the American school of thought which promotes it. She said, why should a group of men, and I stress men, long since deceased, be allowed to constrain the progressive development of the American Constitution? She went on to say, why should they put it into an 18th century straitjacket? Let us ask ourselves what the United States framers' intent was on the issue of the rights of women. We must keep in mind that we are talking about a period long before women had the right to vote, a period when married women had no legal existence separate from their husbands. Surely women's rights, Justice Wilson says, were not high on the agenda of the framers of the American Constitution. Well, haven't times changed, she asks. Today's approach to women's rights is informed by an overall societal commitment to sexual equality. And yet, if we took the framers' intent school seriously, we would be forced to admit that today's social commitment does not reflect an original constitutional truth. Thus, we can see that in certain cases, it would be unthinkable to allow the framers' intent to govern constitutional interpretation. So instead of adopting the framers' intent approach, you can see it wasn't very popular, the Canadian Supreme Court came down firmly on the side of a purposive approach to constitutional interpretation. Justice Wilson describes this approach as being based on the premise that the Charter's purpose is to protect those typically shut out of the political process from an overbearing collectivity, the poor, the oppressed, the powerless, and racial minorities. She said, judges must ask themselves how a climate might be created in which the quality of life of all Canadians can be enhanced and their aspirations for self-fulfillment fully realized. The purposive approach embraces the view that the true test of rights is how well they serve the less privileged and the least popular segments of society. The belief that the Charter gives voice to important national values embraced by all Canadians has led the court to not only interpret government activity very broadly, it has resulted in Charter principles, especially equality principles, being applied in an array of non-Charter cases. But a basic trust and reliance on government, in my opinion, fails to adequately explain the truly radical doctrinal metamorphosis these judgments represent. The recognition by the court that hate propaganda and pornography harm equality rights was a metamorphosis. Favoring equality in the balance against freedom of expression was truly radical. Justice Rosalie Abella of the Ontario Court of Appeal picks up this theme in her description of equality. She says equality is evolutionary in process as well as in substance. It is cumulative, it is contextual, and it is persistent. Equality is at the very least freedom from adverse discrimination. But what constitutes adverse discrimination changes with time, with information, with experience, and with insight. What we tolerated as a society 150 or even 10 years ago is no longer necessarily tolerable. Equality is thus a process of constant and flexible examination, of vigilant introspection, and of aggressive open-mindedness. In their first opportunity to define discrimination and equality, and to address the scope of the equality guarantees, it was evident that the court saw the role of the Charter as fundamentally anti-majoritarian and as a vehicle to redress past wrongs. Sweeping away centuries of accepted law, the court created a new test to measure discrimination in terms of social, political, and economic disadvantage. If a claimant is a member of a group which has experienced persistent disadvantage on the basis of personal characteristics such as sex or race, and if the measure under attack continues or worsens that disadvantage in ways that doesn't disadvantage other individuals or groups, it violates the equality guarantee. Intention to discriminate is not relevant. And only those who fall into persistently disadvantaged groups may claim protection of the equality guarantee. Procedurally, the test provided an escape from abstract formal rules and the doctrinal straitjackets they had created. Instead, it situated constitutional law right in the middle of the messy reality of life. Women and disadvantaged minorities could now tell judges their stories, tell the court why they are persistently disadvantaged because of sexual violence, pregnancy, racism, homophobia, unequal pay, lack of reproductive self-determination, or any other systemic barrier. Then the court looks at the law, the policy, the government action in question, and determines whether or not it perpetuates or increases their disadvantage. If it does, it is discriminatory. This approach paved the way for many new constitutional claims to be made, particularly gender-specific ones. For example, it can now be argued that laws limiting access to abortion, ineffective or badly enforced laws dealing with sexual assault and wife abuse, evidentiary rules in rape cases, it can be argued that these laws are unconstitutional. This really is the key to understanding the decisions in the pornography and hate propaganda cases. Once the court decided that a purpose of approach required a contextual analysis, the door opened for women and minority groups to make their case for constitutionally supportable regulation of hate propaganda and pornography. When law prohibits messages that certain members of Canadian society should not enjoy equality and are not deserving of concern and respect and consideration, that law is promoting the values central to a free and democratic society, and therefore is constitutionally significant. This tells us that no rights in the Charter can be assessed in isolation from other Charter rights. The Charter is a seamless web of interdependent rights. Now, in pre-Charter doctrine, I think it is fair to say, Canadian courts regarded the free speech principle, much like you do, as the cornerstone of all democratic freedoms. After the Keekstra decision, equality and freedom of expression appear to be equally fundamental to our system of democracy. Now, earlier cases had already established that for the purposes of Charter interpretation, not all expression is considered to be equally worth protection, nor are all infringements of expression equally serious. This assessment depends on the factual and social context of the case. For example, statutory limits on commercial advertising are considered less serious infringements than limitations on expression affecting participation in the political process or achieving spiritual or artistic self-fulfillment.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a speech by Canadian law professor and litigator Kathleen Mahoney, speaking to a law conference in Chicago about two cases she argued before the Canadian Supreme Court. In Keekstra versus Regina, a schoolteacher argued his freedoms of belief and expression were violated when he was charged with the crime of promoting hatred for teaching that Jews are evil and the Holocaust was invented to gain sympathy. The court ruled that a prohibition on promoting hatred was a justifiable curb on free speech. Next, Mahoney describes Regina v. Butler, which relied in part on that precedent.
Now let me turn to Regina and Butler. The case arose in 1987 when Mr. Butler, an employee, were charged with some 250 violations of the obscenity provisions. In fact, the entire inventory of Mr. Butler's store was seized. The accused challenged the definition of obscenity in the criminal code as a violation of his freedom of expression guaranteed by the Charter. The definition of obscenity is as follows. Any publication, a dominant characteristic of which is the undue exploitation of sex, or of sex and any one or more of crime, horror, cruelty and violence, shall be deemed to be obscene. By the time the case reached the Supreme Court of Canada, the Keekstra case had been decided. Even though it was a close 4-3 decision, the idea that expression could be more than speech, that it could amount to discrimination, was the crucial breakthrough which established a legal foundation to argue in Butler that pornography could be constitutionally regulated on a harms-based equality analysis. The format for deciding the case was the same as it was in the hate propaganda cases. Did the obscenity law violate the freedom of expression provision? If so, could it be justified under Section 1 of the Charter as a reasonable limit prescribed by law in a free and democratic society? The answers to both questions, as in the hate propaganda cases, were the same. But this time, it was a full court of 9 judges, and the decision was unanimous. Not only did all 3 dissenting judges join the majority, one of the dissenters in Keekstra, Mr. Justice Sopinka, authored the decision for the court in Butler. For more than 300 years, the objective underlying obscenity law was sexual morality. The law was meant to prevent moral corruption through exposure to sexually explicit materials. Its effect was to allow the state to coercively impose majoritarian moral values on minorities. In Butler, the court accepted the argument that such a purpose is no longer defensible under the Charter. The focus on morality and prurient interest is what has obscured pornography's discriminating effects on women for so long. When courts are governed by a morality standard, they start from the assumption that sexual displays are immodest and unchaste, women's naked bodies are indecent, homosexuality is repulsive, and sex outside traditional marriage is a sin. Applied to material charged as obscene, women not only fall through the cracks in the legal analysis, their exploitation is often legitimized by liberal judges unable to abide the morality standard. It said the harm sought to be avoided by obscenity laws is harm to society. Avoidance of such harm justifies some restrictions on freedom of speech. The social character of the harm was likened to that of hate propaganda, in that it prescribed material which attempts to make degradation, humiliation, victimization, and violence against mostly women appear normal and acceptable. The constitutional character of the harm is that charter values of equality and physical integrity are offended. The court's contextual analysis revealed that pornography is commonplace, socially accepted, and widely distributed across Canadian society, where women are not only socially, economically, and politically subordinate to men, but rape, battery, prostitution, incest, and sexual harassment are everyday realities millions of women endure. While admitting that direct harm is not susceptible of exact proof, discrimination, violence, the abject and servile victimization of women and children, the legitimation of detrimental male-female stereotypes, these were all cited as examples of the harm which seriously offend fundamental Canadian values, which Parliament constitutionally is entitled, indeed required, to protect. The court said that in such a context, it is reasonable to conclude that there is an appreciable risk of harm to society in the pornographic portrayal of such material. The inference of harm it creates, it said, is sufficient to justify legislation to control it. Further support for the validity of the objective was found in international conventions. Canada is obliged to respect several international conventions which address either women's equality rights or specifically the control of international flow of obscenity. The court also mentioned one of the factors in supporting the substantial concern test was the fact that pornography is a burgeoning industry. The court said that this renders the concern even more pressing and substantial. The question of rationality, does the law do the job Parliament wants it to do, brought the court into the difficult question of causation. Civil liberties groups and Mr. Butler argued that no causal link with direct harm has been proven, so therefore the law cannot be said to be rationally connected with its purpose. After canvassing the social scientific research and acknowledging some of the differences of opinion on the question of causality, the court said proof of a direct causal link is not necessary to constitutionally justify the legislation. In a situation of conflicting social science evidence, the question is whether the government has a reasonable basis for concluding that material which depicts violence, cruelty, and dehumanization in sexual relations causes harm. Here they found it did. This position is consistent with the position set out by the U.S. Supreme Court in Paris Adult Theater in Slayton, which was referred to in the judgment. Civil libertarians further argued that the objectives of preventing harm to women could be met by less intrusive alternatives. They suggested, for example, that time, place, and manner restrictions would be preferable to outright prohibition. They maintained that if pornography encourages violence against women, activities that discourage it, such as counseling rape victims to charge their assailants, provision of shelter for battered women, campaigns for law reform and education of law enforcement agencies, should be used instead of anti-pornography laws. In response, the court said, once it has been established that the objective of the law is avoidance of harm, it was untenable and hypocritical to argue that these harms could be avoided by access restrictions. Merely making harmful material more difficult to obtain surely defeats the law's purpose, as the harm remains the same, regardless of its conditions of use. On the argument that better battered women's shelters be provided, or that support be provided to rape victims to report their assailants, the court said that these surely are responses to the harm engendered by negative attitudes towards women engendered by the pornography itself. Obviously, they concluded that these suggestions do nothing to prevent harm, which is Parliament's objective. Some members of the gay and lesbian community and sex trade workers criticized the decision because they believe the degrading test will be used against gay erotica. Some say the words degrading and dehumanizing, used to describe pornography in Butler, are no less vague than the words immoral and indecent, used in seizures of gay material by Canadian customs officials during the past 16 years. Some say that protection for women and children is a mere euphemism for guarding public morals. They doubt that any causal link exists between pornography and violence, reasoning that violence against women and children existed long before the printing press and the camera. The result of the Butler decision, in their view, will be continued harassment of gay and lesbian bookstores and discrimination against lesbians and gay men. The conclusion of the proponents of this view is that no law should exist to limit sexual expression. While having no law would certainly contribute to the development of feminist erotica by eliminating the danger of it being used to suppress lesbians and other forms of feminist sexual images, but the question must be asked on balance: would this approach more readily achieve equality in the social conditions of men and women? I think that to say it would is naive. The lessons of history have taught us that the unhindered marketplace of ideas means freedom for the powerful to exploit the powerless. To assume that no law would put women in a better place than Butler does relies heavily on liberal ideology, which history also shows has never worked in favor of women and disadvantaged minorities. The Butler decision, on the other hand, attempts to strike a balance. It marks progress to the extent that it requires an analysis of how sex is used against women. It admits that sex is gendered. It identifies harms, and it limits expression on the basis of values that all Canadians share. If overzealous or homophobic customs officials or police officers apprehend materials at gay and lesbian bookstores that are not being apprehended elsewhere, the issue is not over-expansive breadth and vagueness in the law, but rather unlawful actions by the state. The possibility of illegal police harassment, as objectionable as it may be, has therefore minimal bearing on the proportionality question and must be dealt with in ways other than repealing the obscenity laws. I can think of a way under the equality provisions of the Charter finding their behavior unconstitutional. Having said all of this, however, I believe the court could have done a better job. I think it is interesting that the three dissenting judges from the Keekstra trilogy changed sides in Butler. Unfortunately, there is little in the judgment explaining precisely why they changed their position. One thing the court did mention that distinguished the two cases was the widespread proliferation of pornography and economic benefit derived from it. It is unfortunate, in my view, that the court stopped there and did not examine or articulate other reasons which could have strengthened their opinion, which must have been that pornography makes a much stronger case for regulation than hate propaganda does. For example, the court never really examines or explains the violent category of pornography. The fact that, unlike hate propaganda, direct physical violence to real people is inflicted to make some forms of visual pornography. Like child pornography, mass marketing of such assaults provides a profit motive for physically harming people. This kind of individualized harm was neglected in the judgment. Similarly, there was no mention of how pornography is used to discriminate on the basis of race, age, and sexual preference. Notwithstanding the fact that several international conventions address it, and international law is required to control it, no uniform definition of pornography exists. Western countries, with the exception now of Canada, still have morality-based laws which in most cases go largely unenforced, while pornography and hate propaganda work their way into satellite communications transmitted transnationally and global computer networks, to say nothing of the proliferation of the pornographic view of women in all other forms of international communications. I began my remarks tonight with a brief overview of the Canadian constitutional approach to the interpretation of rights, explaining that it was the key to understanding the Keekstra and Butler decisions. It is the key because the contextual purpose of harms-based equality approach in those two cases exposed previously hidden underlying facts and issues. This, in turn, affected how the issues were framed and how legal principles were applied. In the result, it challenged the assumption that human behavior can be generalized into natural universal laws. It challenged the civil liberties tradition centered on the individual's relationship to the state to emphasize the importance of the relationship of individuals to one another. It recognized that not all people suffer historic generic exclusion because of their group membership, and it recognized that intellectual pluralism does not and cannot mean that racism or sexism will be given the same deference as tolerance. Finally, it recognized that equality is an emerging right. Establishing it requires reciprocity of respect and parity of regard for physical dignity and personal integrity. It recognized that legal interpretation must be guided by these values if the mandate of equality is ever to be met. The goal of a more humane and egalitarian society requires a new conversation, new ways of talking about freedom of expression and its appropriate limits. That conversation began in an official way in the Supreme Court of Canada. The momentum against legalized violence and hatred is small, but it's growing. It's meetings like this that will make a difference. Thank you.
Kathleen Mahoney's address to the University of Chicago Law School Conference on Speech, Equality, and Harm was recorded by Leanne Lauder in 1993 and edited for Wings by Rose Imperato. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to all Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.